CITR 101.9 FM Inkstuds. This is the radio show where we talk about comics. That was a little bit of Karlheinz Stockhausen. Wonderful stuff. Great German avant-garde composer who was a teacher to Holger Zucke from Cannes. A little knowledge of why Stockhausen is important, not only for his own music, but Holger Zucke went on to kind of start a whole new music movement in Germany. And our guest today is kind of like that for the comics world. He was a bit of a teacher for a bunch of excellent comic artists and also inspired a lot of other artists. And I'm very excited to have him on. It's Baron Story. Do I have you there, Baron?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. So thank you for joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. I'm flattered, actually.
as I said before, Don and I are both big fans of your work, and I'm excited. I have my hands, my filthy little hands, on a copy of Life After Black, your new book, flown in from Belgium.
I'm glad you've got it. Have you had a chance to look at it?
Oh, yeah. I've had it for, I guess, about a month now, I think. Or, I don't know. A couple weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
I ordered it as soon as I knew I was able to, and Don and I both got a copy, and we both love it.
It's gorgeous.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really glad you enjoy it. Yeah. It's a verbatim print of one of my journals, and I know we're scheduled to talk about comics. So,
well, no, we're going to talk about your work.
Yeah,
about my work.
Yeah, in general, just.
Alrighty.
We're a comic show, but I mean, like, I've done an interview with Ralph Steadman, who isn't a comic artist, but I mean, he's had a lot of influence on the comic scene. And your work has had a tremendous influence as well, as you've been a teacher to a lot of artists. Should I name drop the people?
Actually, that's one of the first things I was going to ask is what I keep hearing, like, I hear so many people say that you're an influence to them, but I've never been really clear on who were people that you actually studied under you as a teacher.
I had the good fortune of having a group of artists in my illustration classes at Pratt in New York years ago who were inclined towards comics and. Unlike most of the illustration teachers, I was green-lighting that. I said, go for it. And these guys went out and made names for themselves in the field. And it was incredible to me, but I had Kent Williams and George Pratt and John Van Fleet and Peter Cooper and Seth Tabachman.
Oh, I didn't know Cooper Tabachman?
Is yeah.
How you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Seth and Peter are responsible for the publication World War III.
Yeah, it's one of the best, I think, political cartoon magazines available.
It was, I think it was Peter I was already teaching illustration values to very inspired young artists who would go on to start doing painted comics. But it was Peter who actually asked me to do a comic, my first ever, in a magazine produced there at Pratt called Ubiquitous.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had never done a comic before. Well, that's not exactly true, but I'd never had one printed before.
And I actually found it fascinating to hear that you were... Is it true that you were never a fan of comic books in general?
The fact is, I was when I was very young. I was... I'm cautioned not to be too digressive, but here's a little quick anecdote. My uncle worked at a paper factory, and one day he brought over a pile of about 300 comic books that were about to be shredded. He asked me if I wanted them, and, you know, what am I going to say, no?
Yeah.
You know? And I had looked at comic books from time to time, but I hadn't gotten deeply into it at all. And here was a pile of stuff that was like a treasure trove. And in it, I discovered EC Comics, Entertaining Comics. And I liked them a lot. They were great.
were there any artists from EC that really stood out to you?
I was a big Wally Wood fan from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
Wood did a story, I think it was in Weird Fantasy Comics, called My World, an autobiographical piece in which he talked about being a comic artist. And I loved this story. And I didn't realize it, but, you know, I was going there. I wanted to be a comic artist. And, you know, it was always in the back of my mind. And I gravitated to drawing-oriented illustration.
Yeah, well, the EC was I think it still holds up as being like probably the company that had the strongest illustrators working with them in the 50s.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Frazetta and Chuck Davis.
Bernie Kriegstein,
yeah, you know. And, you know, the list goes on and on. Al Williamson. Mm-hmm. And there was a bunch of incredible artists. And I love the art. But I also thought the stories were really intelligent and informative.
And now, is there anything, because like the comic work that you do, it almost has on the surface, it almost has nothing in common with you know, like say like old EC comics. And I was wondering if there's anything you took from comics from when you were a kid that you kind of use in your work in some way.
Well, and I think that's an interesting observation, and I suppose it's very true. But to my way of thinking, there is something in common with EC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And without being too pretentious about it, I would say that I found some honesty in EC Comics.
Mm.
And that was a paradigm that I liked. I remember listening to Harvey Kurtzman talk about the struggle he had with a comic called Frontline Combat.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at war, or at least it was a police action that we'd like to think of as a war in Korea at the time.
Yeah.
And it was pretty hard to get the honest scoop about that. And man, I got what I took to be very credible and honest information about Korea right there in the pages of Frontline Combat, and I got it with great drawings.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, actually it is true, because at the time there wasn't even any, like, not a lot of movies were made about Korea, didn't it? Like, there's no television shows based about the Korean War, you know, or anything like that. That's true. I never thought of that.
It's interesting that you compare it to movies, because I liked movies too.
Mm-hmm.
And from my particular perspective, which might be generational, the movies were more honest too. There were, you know, social realist films that were making waves, like the Ilya Kazan films and things like that.
Oh,
on the waterfront.
Mm-hmm, that's the one that was actually just coming to my mind, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought this was great stuff. And I'd have to say that there are still some fantastic films around, but in the interface between art and entertainment, the 50s was kind of a golden age, because we saw some absolutely exemplary work done in the arts that was nevertheless in the popular domain, and that influenced me as well. Also, I like high contrast black and white imagery.
Oh yeah.
And that certainly was an EC trademark.
Oh, definitely. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your journals? Actually, since your new book is
I guess it's journal number 45.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a continuation from understand of the Murat Saad journal, which you had published was in 92.
Yeah, I think that was the year, but I'm a little vague, to tell you the truth. It was actually kind of a battle to get that book published. I'm talking about the Murat Saad Journal.
Mm-hmm.
I had been introduced by my former students and friends in comics to some important people, and one of them showed my work to Kevin Eastman, who at that time had made a lot of money with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and wanted to set up a kind of a blue sky publishing thing where he would publish works that he liked and people that he liked. And Tundra was formed with that ambition, and I got right in there at the right time, I guess. And Kevin agreed to publish one of my journals as a Tundra publication. But by the time I got a great contract, I must say. I thought it was a great one. I got a wonderful advance and all the good stuff.
Good.
I didn't know it at the time, but that was all that I would see from that endeavor.
Yeah.
Things changed over the years, and they kept putting it on hold and putting it on hold. And after a while, after being told by a lot of people that it might not be a seller, and maybe the world wasn't really ready for another look at the Marquis de Sade anyway, there was a strong resistance. But I had the contract. And the contract said this and that, and I wanted it in print. So I fought for it, and Kevin agreed and put it out. But it took about 2.5 years, or maybe more, to get it printed.
Now, I was wondering why you decided to for the first journal that you published, the Murat Saad Journal, why you specifically pick that one, because it wasn't your first journal. It was later on, and after you've been doing them for years, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. It's an interesting thing about the journal process. Basically, I see it as as illustrating your life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes your life is interesting, and
yeah.
And sometimes it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
My first few journals are kind of like home movies. Fun for me to look at and remember, mm-hmm. but not a lot going on narrative-wise. But later on, I got into the habit of adapting things that I was working on in the theater to my journals. If I was doing a show, and I liked the show, I would sort of take the characters from the show and put them into my journals and tell a personal story at the same time that I was telling some other kind of story. And that worked pretty well, I thought. And I was made bold by that to pick that one because I thought it had a little bit of content that wasn't just my personal stuff.
Oh. Yeah, it's funny because I think I've read that you said that you can kind of look back through your journals and sort of relive where you were at the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it reminds, I don't know if you've heard how William Burroughs used to do that. He he had like travel journals that he would have, and he would divide the page, and your journals totally remind me of this, where he would divide the page into three columns, and the first column he would have a list of what he saw on his trip and what he did. And then the second column would be what he was thinking at the time and associations he had with the things he saw. And then the third column was actually quotes from whatever he was reading at the time. And I notice you incorporate a lot of like whatever you're interested in the time seems to go directly into your work.
I didn't know that about Burroughs' process.
Me neither.
That fits perfectly with mine.
Yeah. I found that really interesting.
I'm a huge Burroughs fanatic, and I've never even heard that.
Yeah, it's in the Paris Review interview. You got to check it out. For the Life After Black journal, that was the first one that you did in color. Is that right?
It's the first one that is all color.
All color.
Okay. I had always done color pages when I had the time, but I sort of made the decision to do that one with every page with color on it.
Just to see how you work a bit. So you basically like carry a journal around with you and just draw every day.
That's right.
Okay, I think that's good advice to anybody. But I was going to ask about like the types of how you carry medium around with you, because it seems that you use a lot of like paints and inks and things like that. And are there certain things that you carry with you to do like color work when you're on the road or whatever?
Yeah, I have all kinds of materials and I love them all. Hmm. And in my studio, there are too many things to pick from. But when I'm traveling, I cut it down to my usual pocket full of pens and pencils. And then I carry a really interesting little Winsor Newton watercolor set that my wife Petra found on Martha Stewart's website.
Oh, really? Oh, awesome.
Yeah, the idea of having Martha Stewart in the loop of my art was pretty amazing to me.
Yeah, I wouldn't have saw that coming.
That's a real step.
But it's a cool little set, and I take it everywhere I go. And then I use whatever I find, wherever it is. After a while, you get to thinking you can draw with just about anything.
Yeah. The journals, are they basically reproductions of the original size of the journals as well?
It's exact.
It's exact, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, because I noticed that you had, through the book, it'll have, book one and book two, sort of chapters, and I was wondering if that might have been like a combination of smaller sketchbooks or if it was just a change in theme
No, the sectioning of my journals has become a habit. Mm-hmm. I usually run around 10 pages or so, and then I'm ready for a new start. And so I divide them up, and those are not structural divisions. They're not prearranged. They're kind of like newspapers, you know.
Oh, okay.
This week's paper has this.
Okay.
And next week's paper might have something else.
Yeah, I've also read that you seem to use your journals as almost like a purging or like a
kind of cathartic.
Yeah, like a cathartic way.
Yeah, it's more than that because I'm not aware of what's real until I go to my journal. At this point, it's become such a part of my thought process and my seeing and experiencing of life that it's completely integrated. I carry the thing with me all the time. Sometimes I go someplace, and spend hours and hours and hours doing this or that and come back, and I've never even touched my journal. but it's with me. I remember an advisement to a photographer which was, you know, always have your camera around your neck. And it's kind of like that. It's always with me. As for therapy and that sort of thing, yeah, really that's a big part of it. But mainly it's a means for me to try to figure out, you know, what's going on with me and what's going on with the world around me.
Now, looking at your new one, The Life After Black, is it kind of like the title, is it looking at like a transition in your life from the Marat Saad, which was, I haven't read it, but from what I gather and the theme of it, like when I sat down and watched the Marat Saad, the Peter Brook's movie or the play on movie. Mm-hmm. Is it kind of like a different phase in your life?
The fact is, the thing centers around a relationship. It's two different facets of a relationship that I had. And in one, I've used a fictionalized version of the Marat Saad scenario, and the significant person in my relationship becomes Charlotte Corday. And I start identifying with Mara. And the second one, the table is turned, and the relationship shifts. I'm older. I'm now King Lear. And the other person is now Cordelia. And it's interesting that the two are the opposite in a sense. In one, the woman kills the guy. In the other, the woman dies, you know, and that wipes out the guy as well. These kind of things are not so much planned out or even consciously thought of, as they just seem to occur.
Sort of happy accidents.
Well, I like the Picasso quote, you know, I don't seek, I find.
Hmm.
And I always find stuff. I found an LP record in the little memorabilia store down the street from me of the Marat Saad soundtrack.
Hmm.
And that was just coincidental. But from that experience, I not only did the Marat Saad journals, but I did a whole comic, serialized comic strip based on a character created from a play that I produced, that I was involved in. I had a character called Assassinata, which was just another manifestation of the character that's in these other books. And it all came from the accident of stumbling on to that record.
Yeah, I find that your work really seems to lend itself to a certain type of narrative. I was talking to somebody earlier about how, like a lot of comics, to have any sort of inner dialogue or somebody like a monologue even, or usually that they resort to like little boxes of text around the
talking
page.
Heads.
Yeah, talking heads and boxes of text. And I think yours is like one of the best types of comics I've seen for being able to incorporate any sort of inner dialogue like into the actual design of the page, and it works so well. I think it's just it do you see your work lending itself more easily to that type of narrative than opposed to a Superman story or something?
Your Burroughs comparison
mm-hmm.
was perfect. I'm convinced that basic Superman narrative kind of stuff is too simplistic to really tell something about life. Life seems multi-layered to me. My illustrations are multi-layered. The meanings that come out of the drawings are multi-layered. For some, that's just confusion and narcissism. But as far as I'm concerned, I can't imagine that everybody isn't the same. Everybody experiences ambiguities and contradictions and paradoxes in their take on life. And why not include that in the presentation of a story, or at least the sharing of life experience?
I think I'm going to pull out a little quote here that I think is sounding a little apt. I think it was Brian Geisen who said that, books were so many years behind artwork, like painting and stuff like that. And does that seem like with comics, where they're still behind as far as like stretching out into utilizing the media and really playing with it as an art form?
Yeah, I like that quote. I'm critical of comics. I've kind of been forced into being somebody who has to take a position, and it's awkward because I'm not a big reader of comics. I like to look at them. I suppose I'm still the kid who likes to look at the pictures, but it is the thing that he's referring to, the nonlinear communication of painting,
mm-hmm.
that I really miss in a lot of storyline-driven comics.
It also reminds me of, I remember I read something written about Picasso and Georges Braque at the, like when they started Cubism, and it said that that Braque was able to go deeper into Cubism quicker than Picasso, because Picasso was mostly doing portraits, and he had a hard time breaking up a human form. He wanted to still keep it human, but Braque was doing still lifes and houses and things, so he had no problem distorting it easier. And I was wondering if that might be the same with like an inner dialogue, where it's kind of people
aren't having the comfortable just to rip it apart.
Yeah, to kind of piece it, like, or to take it apart and put it back together in a way that may not be linear or something. I don't know.
Wow, that's an interesting thing. I'd never heard that story about Picasso and Braque.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to think about it a little bit, perhaps. But there's some truth to the fact that there are different thresholds. You know, you more easily slice and dice certain things,
mm-hmm, yeah.
and others you want to state very emphatically. I did a magazine once about AIDS,
mm-hmm.
and I published a little magazine with my students called Watch Magazine, and we did thematic issues. We did one about AIDS, and coming right here from San Francisco, this is a major issue. This is back in the 80s, and all of a sudden, I found you just couldn't be glib. You couldn't make symbolic stuff. The reality of AIDS was too crushing. So it ended up more or less, at least my part of the magazine, ended up just doing straight drawings of people who were showing the effects of AIDS. And like those great Jericho drawings of the people who were insane,
mm-hmm.
You get the feeling that a little bit of telling stuff is coming through a straight portrayal. And on the other hand, when something is, you know, when you have a sarcastic attitude and it doesn't seem to matter anyway, and you're more or less expressing that attitude, you're free to just be outrageously deconstructive with something.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you just said. I was thinking that it reminded me of like the September 11th. After the September 11th stuff, that when people were coming up with sort of comic book tributes, it was either something like where they don't even really talk about it and they talk about something personal, or else it was kind of trite. You know, it would be like somebody looking up at a firefighter or something, you know, and it's that, I think it's probably that same type of balance you were talking about with like dealing with a subject like AIDS, where it's either kind of really trite or heavy, and you have to run that real balance between it.
The comparison is a very good one, and I like that you brought that up, because the fact is, it gives me a chance to mention, and I always want to mention, my teacher. My teacher was Robert Weaver at SVA in New York, and this man made all the difference to me about illustration and visual communication in general. And when it occurred, I was like so many others. I was stunned to complete immobility.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do a damn thing. It seemed worthless to put marks on a page. And I knew a lot of artists who felt the same way. But I started thinking, you know, if I had been in Weaver's class, what would have happened? He would have kicked our butts to get down there and draw what we saw. And I actually saw images that were profound. The people pasting their photocopies on the wall, on the armory, a whole block of people taping, you know, one thing so close to another that was overlapping with scotch tape. All a person would have had to have done would be to go there and sit there and draw that. And it would have been, at least it seems to me, a more profound record of that time than the familiar video clips that we see, you know, the people running down the street, the boiling stuff coming out of the building. It would have spoken to the experience more profoundly. And I asked illustrators in New York that I knew, did you do that? Did you go down there? Did you draw that? And as you just said, even the people who really tried to deal with it, and some of them dealt with it very well, but most of them just kind of did a kind of, oh, where were you when 9/11 occurred, kind of thing. They didn't do the documentary footwork and get themselves down there and see what was going on and put it down on paper or whatever. And I use that as a kind of an example of the motivation that really makes illustration important. If that had been done, we'd have a better record of that time.
So, speaking of Robert Weaver, these are the what other things did you take from his teaching? It sounds do you apply anything that you learned from his teaching to when you teach?
Absolutely. I don't do it very well compared to him, but I do my best because I have almost messianic belief that his message makes all the difference. And so I just did a workshop in Ecuador, which was called Seeing is Not Believing, which is a Robert Weaver quote. And I try hard, even when it's in a different language, to communicate the uniqueness of his contribution. I'm not the only one. Everybody who had him feels it. And, one of the reasons that teaching is okay and not just an escape from being a freelancer or whatever.
Actually, I was going to ask about speaking of teaching, I really like the watch annual that you put out that had the sample of the handouts that you would give to your students. I found that just absolutely fascinating. Just like your ideas on how to improve your illustration and how to think about illustration. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've had a lot of good responses to that. And I just made a note I'm going off to do the Illustration Academy thing in Florida this weekend, and I just made a note to myself, take along the tech review, which is what I call that stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to see like an entire phone book full of stuff like that. I found it just fascinating. Yeah, like a textbook. I thought it was just fascinating.
I've been asked a few times to expand it, and really one of my friends just pleads with me to expand it.
Yeah, I'll plead too.
I haven't gotten to it. I've kind of resisted. I'm so super glad to get some of my journals printed. I've been waiting since the Murat Saad one for another chance, and thanks to Carl Weikert, I'm getting that chance. But I was sort of reluctant to do a how-to book, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I understand.
Or a retrospective of my illustration career book.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted instead for something more alive to be presented. And I thought, well, look, I'm doing all these books, and I think they're worth looking at. And certainly when I show them in my gallery shows, people study them for hours and hours.
Oh, yeah.
And so why not print that? But until Carl, no one would take me up on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The realities of the economic realities of publishing.
Yeah. I was actually really pleasantly surprised when I opened up the new Swallow book. I bought that, and then I opened it up and went, oh, there's Baron Story stuff. Because I noticed you had like some stuff from one of your journals from Nigeria that I thought was just stunning.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's a compendium of various. It's a sampler from various journals, yeah. And I have to be grateful for being asked to put that in there. It's happening. It is happening, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm getting some of this stuff out.
One story I have a bunch of questions about is for Neil Gaiman, you did the Despair story in the Endless Nights collection. And I was wondering the process for putting that together, because it's, I think Dave McKeon kind of designed it, but did you basically have the dialogue and then just do the art reflecting what Neil had written?
What was your process working with Neil, I guess, is that?
Well, that's a story, another story. I met Neil years ago, and he wrote actually an embarrassingly flattering description for the back of my book, Murat Saad. And so we had a bit of a relationship, and I got into his Sandman universe out of my admiration for Dave McKean's covers and started checking it out, really liked it. And an editor at DC asked me to participate in a Sandman deck of cards. And arbitrarily, I think, I don't remember clearly, I was given a directive on what character to do, and it was Despair. And I checked out that character, and I just instantly loved the character. Mm-hmm. To be fair, I had a different take on Despair than many, many artists, and maybe even Neil himself.
I'm going to interrupt you right now, because I was thinking the same thing. I read this interview with Mike Dringenberg, who drew the first few Sandman issues, and he said that the only character that he thought that Neil Gaiman never got his head around was the Despair character, and he said solely from the fact that Neil Gaiman is not the type of person that despairs about anything. And I thought that might have been fairly true.
Yeah, well, for the record, my take on Despair is that she is a total empath without a life. Mm-hmm. Basically, she's a character that can't feel anything until she's close to somebody who's feeling something very profoundly. And this has a even masochistic level in it. And I relate to that. I was I lived, my youth was spent in a very troubled family. There was a lot of bad stuff happening. Mm-hmm. And I was mellow. I was okay. I didn't really react to a lot of it. But the feeling of drama was always around me. And after a while, I began to realize that, oh, my God, I'm channeling this. I mean, this isn't me. But I am all upset because I'm near somebody who's feeling that. Mm-hmm. And so that was my take on Despair. She was a pathological empath. Yeah, and
That actually reminds me, Alan Moore did a story about an angel that was it's like a beautiful woman who's an angel that's basically a heroin addict because she can't deal with loving everybody. It hurts her too much. It reminded me of that.
Yeah, I think that's that kind of psychological backstory is really, really close to where I'm at. So I liked the character. I liked her a lot. And I liked her so much that I did my own complete journal based on the character, which was called The Book of Despairs. And during one of Neil's speaking engagements over in Oakland, I hung out to show him that book with kind of the idea of maybe you'd be interested in this. And he'd been up all night or something like that. I don't know. He came in late, didn't have much time. And, you know, he's so popular that he's just a huge fan crush wherever he goes. And so he looked at the book, and, you know, my impression was, yeah, well, he didn't go for that at all. It was just too bloody far out for him. That impression lasted for years. It was, hang on to your hat, it was 7 years later that someone told me that Neil had said on his website that he was going to do the Book of Despairs with Baron Story.
Oh, first, really?
First I had heard of it. I had no idea. But it was exciting. I love talking with him about it. But as I said, he was very busy. He was doing a book signing tour for Coraline at that time. And it was hard for me to even get in touch. Neil isolates himself when he writes in something that his people refer to as his cabin. Actually, I believe a former motel somewhere in the woods in Minnesota, I'm not sure. I did decide that I want a cabin, too. Yeah. But the bottom line on it is that I got no script. And the deadline started getting close. And so I just went ahead and did something along the lines of my original Book of Despairs, a series of portraits. He had named the thing 15 Portraits of Despair, and that's all I had was a name. But I thought, okay, I can do 15 portraits. What I didn't realize is he didn't mean 15 Portraits of Despair, a character.
Oh.
He meant 15 portraits of the condition of despair.
Oh.
But I had no way of getting in touch. He was in his cabin. And there's no phone, no computer, no nothing.
Not a single luxury.
Anyway, I went ahead and did the 15 Portraits of Despair and sent them to D.C. on deadline without a text of any kind. And they loved him. But, of course, it was Neil's book. And, you know, what could he do? So I sent them to him. He liked them. He just said, we cut a deal where we would use half of them and I would create another half in response to some new writings of his. And he decided to do them not in sequential, but in a kind of a haiku poem on the page form. And that really worked for the drawings.
Mm-hmm.
It's fabulous for the drawings. And it also works, by the way, in readings. When he came to San Jose to do a reading, he read all the stories in my despair section. So I modified some, and I created others to his text, and I had this huge pile of stuff, and I didn't know how to edit it. And I sent it all to the editors and said, you know, here's what I've got. Here's the way I think it works with the text. I'm not sure. And that was a big problem. And Dave stepped in and solved that. Out of the pure generosity of his spirit, he liked what I had done. He liked what Neil had created. He sat down and fixed it. And, you know, eternal gratitude.
Yeah, I actually, I met, I didn't realize, has Ape already happened?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't realize you were going to be at Ape this year. I might have came down again this year because I met Alan Spiegel last year when I was there, and I picked up the Dave McKean Pictures at Tick book, and I thought it was just beautiful. I'm a big fan of his.
Oh, Dave is the one that really made me take things seriously as far as comics are concerned. I had, I played around with it. I liked the fact that my students were now famous as comics artists. That was cool, but it was Dave that more or less made the point to me that you had to go there. It wasn't just something that you could, be a fan about. His position was, look, if you want to understand what's happening in the graphic arts, you have to go and check out what's happening in comics. And I took him at his word because he was so good. He's just incredible. I bought into Photoshop because of Dave McKean. I bought into comics because of Dave McKean.
I bought into Photoshop after him too.
I was resistant to comics and Photoshop, but look at what Dave does with it. So I considered it important that I try to hip up on it. And the graphic novel is a great form. When I saw things like Bill Sienkiewicz's Straight Toasters, or something like that, even with the superhero narratives, just the sheer awesomeness of the artwork really, really did it for me. My student, George Pratt, shortly after I had him in class, was doing what I still consider an amazing graphic novel, Enemy Ace.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's fabulous. It's his best work.
My favorite thing he did was the No Man's Land. That's the book of pictures from World War One.
Yeah. Sketch.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was just stunning.
Unbelievable. And it's right on point, since right now I'm working on a World War One project, and George owns that. But yeah, Enemy Ace was all painted.
Yeah,
every damn page, and it was just fabulous.
Does that sometimes seem daunting when people do big painted projects like that? Because it's a lot of work that goes into one of those books. I mean, I know Al Columbia didn't walk out of big numbers. On the best of terms, because it was just so hard on the artist.
Hey, I know. My buddy Kent did Darren Aronofsky's Fountain as a graphic novel.
Oh, yeah.
He worked on it for a year and a half, and he loved it, but it was, like, so arduous. On. So much work to do. It's bad, but... And it doesn't pay, let's put that in.
Yeah.
But I remember when I got very annoyed at doing comics and having no response to them, I went back to New York and I started hanging out with my old buddies, with Seth and Peter, and I was complaining, I'm an illustrator. I expect to be paid for what I do.
Yeah.
And they said, don't you realize? That's not the point.
Yeah, Robert Williams said the best thing about comics was that he said, no one gives a shit about them, so you can do whatever you want. That was the strength.
That's kind of where it's at.
Yeah.
It's not only that you can do whatever you want. The form is about doing things with that uncensored kind of definition of the endeavor.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I had a friend asked me a funny question, and it's kind of a simple question, but he said, you're interviewing Baron's story, ask him where he got the triangles from, because there's triangles prevalent in a lot of your work, and I was wondering where you got that from, and maybe like what problem that you use them to solve in your work.
They come from Africa. Mm-hmm. I went to Africa in 1981 for the National Geographic to paint the rainforest. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see any art there, to my disappointment. Mm-hmm. I had read books on African art and various things, and I'd always liked it. But I didn't realize the cultural situation, at least in West Africa, was that, you know, there was an antagonism towards creating works of art because they became objects of value. And so people painted on their bodies, or they painted things that were destroyed in the process. And there weren't a lot of people who were thinking archival. Mm. Anyway, that came back with me, and it didn't hit me until a little time later. I moved to San Francisco when I met my beloved wife, Petra, and I severed a lot of contacts with my New York illustration clients, and my career began to go way wobbly. And I also had been connected to some very exciting artists in New York, and I was thrilled about what they were doing. This was a period in the early 80s when sort of guerrilla art shows were being staged in abandoned school buildings, and I loved the way fabulous famous artists like Leon Golub would come out and show their works with students and other things in these abandoned buildings. It was so cool. And so I saw a show here in San Francisco called New York Art Now at the Forum. I might have the gallery room. Anyway, I went over just, you know, full of my why did I ever leave Mecca vibe. Went in and saw the show, and it sucked. It was terrible. You know, people told me later, well, you know, New York's changed since you left, Baron. And, you know, not that it was my doing. But all of that righteous stuff that I remembered was gone, and instead there was a lot of, let's call it poser art, you know, unskilled, uncommitted, you know, dilettante on steroid.
Yeah.
Do you want to say any names of people?
Yeah, a lot. I know what you're talking about. It's like the high school kid with an ego or something.
Yeah. And I was totally disillusioned. And that was upstairs at the gallery. I came down the stairway completely shaken. And at the bottom of the stairway, it just happened to be a display case in which there was an African mask covered with triangles. And I had found my African art. And I stood there, you know how it is in life. Sometimes when you're utterly destroyed, you're really receptive to new experience.
That's my experience.
Yeah. And this mask started talking to me. And it's like, I was taught that decorative was a downer, you know, that doing things decoratively was not aesthetically valid. And was this not decoration all over this mask, these triangles? And I went home, and I started fooling around with it, and I started trying it out. And I liked it. The way the triangles were made appealed to me. They weren't planned out and then filled in. They were made one at a time, and each one had to be fairly perfect to fit into the nest of the whole group. And there was an almost prayer-like trance that I would get into while I was creating these triangles that was really a nice balm for the bad feelings that I had had about my disappointment about art. And so I kept doing it. And I talked to Gary Panter at one time, who told me that he also went through a triangle phase and did a whole journal of triangles. So I think some others are discovering this, but anyway, after a while, I began to see it. I mean, I began to identify with it and think about associations. I like the number three. I like triangles a lot because they were derived from threes. Of course, the triangle is at the heart of Euclidean logic. The fact that you can always create a triangle by a certain theorem. The triangle also meant a lot of other things to me. You know, it's structurally powerful and holds up bridges and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, God, you know, triangles are really cool.
But I think we're almost out of time.
We are, Baron. This has been awesome. I'm really happy we got the chance to talk to you. And Don has one last thing to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm hoping to see as many of your books, your journals, into print as possible. Because it like Oscar Wilde, when he was talking about diaries and the importance of being earnest, he said a diary is a record of one's own thoughts and impressions, and consequently meant for publication. And I thought that was kind of applicable here.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure to be on the phone with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Look forward to more work coming out.
Thanks.
Thank you, Baron.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
For all you listening, that was Baron Story, author of the new book, author-artist of Life After Black, Baron Story, The Journals, number 45. That shows you how extensive his journals are. Is it 45? Yeah, it's 45.
Tales from the Edge book's still available.
Tales from the Edge, it's a black and white kind of collection of a bunch of different stuff. I say this book, The Baron Story, Life After Black, and The Sandman are the easiest to get representations of his work. Well, the Baron Story book isn't out yet, but it will be out very soon. You can order it online.
You can order it from it's in the New Previews magazine.
It's in the New Previews. So there you go, kids. For those of you who order through Previews, get your comic store to carry it. It's beautiful. I think you're going to see why this guy has had such an impact on all the great artists out there. And actually, I had tons more questions for him too, but I mean, already past our time and the next guys are here. Yeah. So that was fabulous. Thank you so much, Baron. For you all people in Vancouver, did I say yo?
Yeah, you said yo.
What? This Saturday is the Comic Jam at the Jolly Alderman. I will be there, and I hope you are too. As well,
Saturday starting at 8.
At 8 p.m., Joel Alderman. Bring your pens, bring your erasers,
or
maybe a hard surface to draw on. Or be like me, I can't draw, but I like to hang out with people that draw.
Yeah, the cool kids.
The cool kids. Well, I'm going to refrain from saying that again. And next week's guest will be Eddie Campbell, an interview Colin and I did a couple weeks ago. Don was too ill to come.
I was feeling down.
So can everyone just maybe email in and tell Don how much he sucks for not being there? We love you, Don, as always.
We love you, Robin.
The week after that will be Luke Ramsey and Jim. And I forgot the guy's last name. Oh, but Luke Ramsey, part of the Island, or does the Island Fold. Island's Fold, neat artist. He'll have people in that will stay on his island, on his property on an island, and they will do art. It's very interesting. He's quite an interesting guy, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. He did a great book with Justin B. Williams, which you can pick up at Lucky's, and I don't know if RX has it, but I know Sophia's has it. So there you go. Up next is Crimes and Treasons, and look forward to more great stuff. www.inkstuds.com. Thank you.